You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Folks, do you enjoy listening to Kick-Ass News? Well, then become a part of what I'm doing here and help support the show by going to patreon.com/kickassnews and making a donation. Your encouragement and support is always appreciated. And now, enjoy the podcast.
His search to clear his family's name.
Take a look at this.
Has uncovered a secret he never expected to find.
There is a book, and it has the information you need. The President's Book of Secrets. A collection of documents for President's eyes only. The truth behind the JFK conspiracy. The missing minutes from the Watergate tapes. And of course, Area 51. The only way you'll ever see that book is if you get elected president.
I'm gonna kidnap the President of the United States.
National Treasure, Book of Secrets.
That was the pretty awful sequel to American Treasure, called American Treasure 2, Book of Secrets, made in 2007 on the downward side of Nicolas Cage's acting career. The MacGuffin of the movie is a presidential book of secrets that contains all the most sensitive national secrets and conspiracies in America's 240-year history. It's kept hidden from the public under lock and key, reserved exclusively for the eyes of the 44 men who've served in the White House. The only problem is that, despite what you may have heard or seen on History Channel or The Alex Jones Show, there is no such thing as the President's Book of Secrets. Or is there? Well, there's sort of a President's Book of Secrets, although it's less of a book and more of a daily newsletter with a very exclusive readership. It's classified top secret, and it does contain highly sensitive information. And ever since the Kennedy administration, it's been published 6 days a week for one very special reader, the Commander-in-Chief. The President's Daily Brief, known in national security circles simply as The Book, is a personalized daily report put out by the Directorate of National Intelligence, summarizing what intelligence agencies consider to be the most crucial information for the President to know that day. Throughout much of its 50-year history, the PDB was an open secret in the White House and intelligence circles, but hardly ever acknowledged publicly. It's discussed at length in the very first book about the PDB, called The President's Book of Secrets, The Untold Story of Intelligence Briefings to America's Presidents from Kennedy to Obama, written by the intelligence officer who used to hand-deliver the PDB every morning. His name is Dr. David Preece. He served during the Bill Clinton and George W. Bush administrations as a decorated intelligence officer, manager, and daily intelligence briefer at the CIA, as well as a desk officer at the State Department. Today he'll talk about the history of this most top-secret of documents, how it's tailored to each president's taste, and what kinds of secrets go into the book. We'll discuss the massive intelligence bureaucracy that goes into publishing what is essentially a highly classified daily newspaper created just for one customer. David will reveal what it's like to be the daily briefer who delivers the book every morning and meets privately with the Commander-in-Chief to discuss the most sensitive intelligence matters. We'll talk about which presidents blew off the PDB, which presidents expected almost too much from it, and which presidents like to get gossip on the bedroom antics of their fellow world leaders. Coming up with Dr. David Preece in just a moment. Dr. Dr. David Priest was an intelligence officer at the CIA and a desk officer at the State Department. He worked as a daily intelligence briefer, and he writes about it in a new book called The President's Book of Secrets, The Untold Story of Intelligence Briefings to America's Presidents from Kennedy to Obama. David, thanks for coming in.
Hi, Ben. Good to be here with you.
Well, I got to say congratulations on the book and congratulations on who you got to do the foreword to your book. You got George H.W. Bush to write the foreword for the book. How did you manage that?
Yeah, I won the lottery. How did I manage it? I asked.
Really?
It was that simple.
And you didn't have a relationship with him prior?
Not really.
Or you hadn't served under him?
I had briefed him back when I was at CIA. He was an ex-president by then, but I had briefed him before. But of course, that was many years ago, and I hadn't kept in touch. But when I was doing research on the book, I reached out to him and said, would you like to contribute? Can I get some answers from you? And he said, of course. And he contributed to it. There's a lot of material in the book from him and all the other ex-presidents who contributed. But when I finished it, I went back and I said, you know, I would feel bad if I didn't ask. You're the only man who's been CIA director,
right,
vice president, then president, and, by the way, father of a president who also attended PDB sessions, President's Daily Brief sessions for his son. I said I'd be a fool not to ask. Would you be willing to? And the response was immediate. Yes, I want to.
Wow, that's fantastic. Yeah. And I think you said in the book, he was probably the person who made the best use and appreciated the PDB. Mm-hmm. Best of all the presidents,
right,
coming from that background.
Yeah, he knew what intelligence could do, and he also knew what intelligence couldn't do. He knew the limits of intelligence. So he was someone who used the intelligence sessions, daily briefing sessions with CIA briefers. He used them to inform his policy, but he didn't make excuses when policy didn't work out by blaming the intelligence. Mm-hmm. That's a sophisticated customer, somebody who uses it to the extent that it helps him, but does not use it as an excuse.
Well, you know, the PDB, the President's Daily Brief, for much of its 50-year history, it was shrouded in secrecy. It was not something that was really publicly acknowledged outside of the White House and outside of intel circles. Really, only post 9/11 has it become a subject of interest in the media. So for anyone who still might not know, briefly tell us, what is the President's Daily Brief?
Sure. It's the title of the book gives it away, The President's Book of Secrets. It is the book that goes to every sitting president every working day that contains the intelligence community's most sensitive intelligence reporting and analysis. Often it's about breaking events that day, or it's about things that could become breaking events, warning of crises or threats, or informing the president about opportunities coming up. And it has been a book. It has been a printed document that contains 6 or 8 stories a day with some variety about various places around the world that might be of interest to the president. It is the most tightly controlled document in the world because it does contain very sensitive information from classified sources. Lives are at stake. If this were to be leaked, which it never has been, but if an entire PDB were to be leaked, it would be a very dangerous thing. So it is kept very, very carefully under control. The President's Daily Brief has changed over time, but the things that are the same are in the very name of it, the President's Daily Brief. It's for the president. It's tailored to the personality and the style of the sitting president. It is a daily document, comes every 24 hours, and it is brief. It is only a few articles. The president doesn't have time to read hundreds of pages every day on intelligence.
And prior to JFK, there was no such thing as a physical brief that was handed to the president every morning. How did it evolve into what we call now the President's Daily Brief?
Sure. Going back to FDR, he ran World War II, and he got intelligence, but it was very loose. Wild Bill Donovan of the OSS would pass him memos and reports, but it wasn't focused on the president. Harry Truman did start getting a daily document, the daily summary from CIA when it founded, but it was not personally focused at him. That is, it wasn't written to his personal style. That really started under John F. Kennedy. They started writing a product for him called the President's Intelligence Checklist, shortened to the pickle. And they wrote it specifically for Kennedy. He was a former journalist. They wrote it in a journalistic, casual style without all the classification markings that was all over all kinds of other documents. And because of that, he loved it. And he would carry the thing around with him, and he would react to it, task things based on it to other officials. It ended up morphing into the president's daily brief for his successor, Lyndon Johnson. But that was really the start of presidentially focused intelligence.
And when you say that they tailor it to each president, in what ways have they tailored it? Is it knowing what gets their attention, what form it should come in that they best understand or more likely to read or engage with?
It's all of that. Yeah. It's the content and it's the format. In terms of content, some presidents have wanted more, or they've wanted different kinds of things in their book. And so it's changed over the years. In terms of format, depends on what the president's style is. John F. Kennedy got his so that it was small enough he could fold it in half, put it in his suit coat pocket, carried around with him during the day because he was unwilling and apparently unable to sit still for hours to read intelligence. By the time it got to Richard Nixon, a lawyer, he ended up getting it bound on the top like a legal brief with fact and opinion separated out. Now, President Obama gets his on an iPad. They've changed it from a physical printed book to electrons on a screen. It's still intelligence analysis. It's still top secret information. But it is tailored to the president depending on their style and their preferences.
Have there been presidents who have been less engaged than others?
There certainly have. In some cases, it's a matter of whether they read the book or they take a briefing. But a little bit too much is made of that. People think, oh, if somebody doesn't take a briefing, they don't care about the intelligence. Criticisms have been thrown at President Obama for that.
Right.
But Ronald Reagan never took an in-person briefing from a CIA officer. For 8 years, he read the book and then talked to his national security advisor about it. That's not really the measure of whether they take the intelligence seriously. The one person we don't think took it that seriously was Richard Nixon. By all accounts, he was not a fan of the CIA, especially the analytic side. And the intelligence that he was getting from them, reporting on world events, he seems to have disparaged and dismissed more than incorporated it. But the thing is, we don't know exactly what he did with it because he's not talking anymore. Yeah. He didn't reference it much in his own writings. We have Kissinger, who told me for the book that, yes, of course, Nixon read it, and he gave me some reasons to believe that. Other people think maybe he didn't. That's the big mystery when it comes to this, is how much Nixon really appreciated the reporting there.
Yeah, and it's funny because on one hand, as paranoid as Nixon was, and as much as he loved getting dirt on everyone, you would think that he would eat this up. But he also had this distrust of the CIA, which he saw as a bunch of, and some of them probably were, East Coast, Yale, snobby blue bloods.
The liberal Georgetown set. Both he and Kissinger would use that remark a lot. And there's some truth to that. The recruitment of the agency back then was largely focused on the Ivy League. It was largely a leftist organization, but it was still a patriotic American organization. They still did all kinds of things to support U.S. national interests. But you can understand where he came from on it. They were not necessarily seeing things the way he did. On the other hand, he was very cautious to the point of paranoia. And it seems that even if nothing else, to be a check on Henry Kissinger, his national security advisor and eventual Secretary of State, if nothing else, to have an independent, objective point of view on international affairs, to check on the guy that he relied on but didn't trust 100%, it would surprise me if he did not read the book on a regular basis.
Yeah, and that's interesting what you said about having an independent source for this information.
Right.
Is that really the case? It's basically a daily newspaper created for one person.
There you go. There you go.
With a huge bureaucracy to support that.
Correct.
There have to be agendas that come into play and office politics and...
Well, there's a difference between the bureaucracy that produces this and the newspaper setting. And that is, if you have a newspaper with an editorial line, then a reporter who doesn't subscribe to that either self-selects and doesn't work there, or over time, the editors just kind of push their stuff out of the way. With the president's daily brief, traditionally hasn't worked that way because what you've got is you've got a bunch of intelligence analysts of a variety of political and other backgrounds, but working as civil servants who are analyzing particular countries, putting together pieces for the president's daily brief. And that goes through a very comprehensive, grueling chain of coordination with other analysts working on the topic, with editors, with managers, a lot of eyes on it. Very hard to politicize a product if you're just one person. Now, certainly, CIA directors have gone to the president and put their own slant on things, often arguing against the very content of the president's daily brief that the analysts have produced. But in my research looking at this and in speaking with all of the living former presidents and vice presidents, most of the CIA directors who contributed to the book, we did not find a lot of cases of politicization of people trying to influence policy through the analysis in the book. In fact, the objective of being objective seems to have largely been upheld over the years.
So you don't have any cases where, say, like during the George W. Bush administration, some people in the agencies were pushing weapons of mass destruction or
no,
anything similar to that?
In that case, and thankfully or not, depending on how you look at it, we had the WMD commission that looked intently at the issue of what happened before the assessments about Iraq's WMD. They assessed that there was no politicization. That is, analysts were calling it like they saw it. They were just wrong. Mm-hmm. They looked at all the information they had. They looked at the history of Saddam Hussein. They looked at the things he was doing with having the inspectors come in the front door of a facility and having people running out the back door with files and boxes. All of that looked to them like there must be a WMD program.
Right.
But they were wrong. That was not there. But they did not find evidence that they were slanting the analysis. Now, move forward a few years, and it could look the other way. That is, the Iraq insurgency leading to civil war was not going well. You had analysis in the president's daily brief probably every day saying, things aren't going well. Here's what's not going well. Here's what isn't working. Here's what. And that's a case where, yeah, telling the president news that the president does not want to hear is the uncomfortable but important job of the intelligence community. If the emperor has no clothes, if the policy is not based on what's happening on the ground, that's what the intelligence services are supposed to do. And then a president has two choices. They can say, I don't want to hear this anymore. This is inconvenient for my policy. Go away. I don't want to be briefed. I don't want to read this. Or they can do what George W. Bush did. He actually doubled down on the intelligence at that point. He started taking more briefings. He started getting experts in to talk with him on top of the president's daily brief process. So he ended up getting more intelligence even as they were telling him stuff that was incredibly inconvenient for him and his policies.
You talk about how before he came into office, when he had his first intelligence briefing, once he was a president-elect, they gave it to him, and he said, okay, well, I'm sure once I'm in the White House, you'll give me the good stuff.
Yes.
And apparently they were giving the good stuff, right?
Exactly. Yeah. The leadership of the CIA had a collective heart attack at that point because they had been giving him the president's daily brief. They had been giving him supplementary information and containing all the best stuff. What they interpreted from that was, this book that contains the intelligence analyst's best assessments of foreign affairs isn't going to be enough for this man. He wants the actual spy stories. He wants some of the operational information that goes in here. Usually it informs the assessments. They figured out, oh, he's going to want to see the raw reports. He's going to want to see the whole range of intelligence activities. So they decided to actually break the book open, and instead of printing a published, bound, fancy document every morning, it was going into a three-ring binder, and that meant that the briefer on his way out the door to see the president could just pop it open, put in a cable that had just come in overseas from some CIA station, and supplement the book with that sexy spy story in addition to the classified top-secret intelligence.
Now, is there a downside to the president wanting to micromanage it and focus too much on the details?
Yeah, I mean, any president has a really, really tight schedule. The president's schedule is managed down to the minute. And every minute that the president decides to spend reading an extra spy story instead of doing something else, you have got the chief of staff, the domestic advisors, the other advisors banging on the door saying, we have to get him for this. So there is that tension. The other tension on the political side of it is, well, should somebody be spending that much time on the intelligence? Well, I can certainly understand George H.W. Bush spending a lot of time on intelligence at the end of the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
This was a massive foreign policy, national security issue to try to handle, and intelligence would help him do that. In any given administration, my background in intelligence and national security, of course, I think it's the most important thing. I think every president should be spending half of every day reading the intelligence and doing that. But I also understand there's a whole lot else going on in governance that demands their time.
Does the president get a briefing from every department every day, and this one's just sexier because it's so secret?
I have found no parallel to the president's daily brief. I have no suspicion. I have no reason to believe that other presidents did not receive something from their chief of staff, a rundown of the day's events, which included a version of analysis of what congressional vote was going to be or what some governor was going to do. There probably is that, but it is not institutionalized in the same way, where it is a scrupulously neutral, objective assessment of affairs. Everyone else is a political advisor by definition. The only neutral part of the U.S. government without a policy objective is the analysis wing of the intelligence community. Their job is to call it like they see it, regardless of what policies the State Department, the Defense Department, the Treasury Department, and others are putting forward.
Are there examples where an article that the president read in his morning PDB somehow led to action that same day? Or you can draw a direct line that led to action on the part of the president?
Yeah, the ex-presidents that I talked to for the book all said that they had those moments. Some of them were very serious. Some of them not so serious, but direct action nonetheless. I'll give you one serious one. Bill Clinton, who actually had a real ebb and flow with the PDB. He did not always take a briefing. He was notoriously bad at managing his schedule, among other things. He sometimes read the book, sometimes got briefed on it. He remembers a time when he read a book about tensions between Pakistan and India while they were going to war. And it gave him the message that they're not aware of each other's nuclear capabilities and intentions, and they're about to go to that level. He used it that very day. He used the information from that PDB to walk the Prime Minister of Pakistan back from the ledge and get him to pledge to withdraw his troops. That's impact. That's averting a potential nuclear war. Now, there's impact in another way, which is a little more fun. And that's examples of some of the presidents who have had some humor in their president's daily brief.
Right.
His predecessor, again, George H.W. Bush, he had such a good relationship with his briefers, and he took the intelligence so damn seriously on the major issues that he was able to have some fun with it. So there was an election prediction in the PDB in Nicaragua when there were the first open elections. The PDB analysis predicted that Daniel Ortega was going to win, that the powers of the incumbency would give him the advantage. Bush looked at the piece, and he looked at his briefer, and he said, "I bet you an ice cream cone that this is wrong." What are you going to do? You're the president's briefer and he wants to make a wager with you. You take it. He did. But the next day he had to bring in an ice cream cone because the president was right. The analysts were wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't want to make that bet with a former director of the CIA. No. We're going to take a quick break and then I'll be back to talk more with Dr. David Preece when we come back in just a moment. If you're enjoying my conversation with David Preece, then check out his book, The President's Book of Secrets, The Untold Story of Intelligence Briefings to America's Presidents from Kennedy to Obama. And right now, you can download the audio version of his book for free with a special promotion just for our listeners from audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickassnews for a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download, which can be The President's Book of Secrets by my guest today, David Preece, or any of Audible's 180,000 titles. That's audibletrial.com/kickassnews. Or click on the sponsor link on our webpage to download the free audiobook of your choice. And now, back to the show.
You talk about how the highlight for many presidents would be when the analysts would throw in some salacious story about what other world leaders were up to in their romantic life and little personal tidbits. You talk about how George H.W. Bush liked to know what his counterparts were going to be doing on the weekends. Mm-hmm. Which president was the biggest gossip during his briefing?
It seems to be a tie between two guys who had plenty of gossip about themselves as well, and that's John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. The two of them, by some of the CIA veterans who are now long retired, but they told me some of the stuff they wrote for the PDB. It was about affairs of foreign leaders, and it was about what was going on here and there. And they said that it was a very politically, I think Bob Gates told me that, it was a very politically incorrect time, and you could put stuff in there that was just, it would be unbelievable now. George H.W. Bush probably did the same thing, and I would venture every president got something like that that's useful in terms of what is this foreign leader doing this weekend, or what is his domestic political constraint, and where does that give us a lever? Where does that give us an opportunity to call right at this time when it's most convenient to get across this point for U.S. policy.
Yeah,
that's good. That's good intelligence analysis, and
so
that
there
helps
is a
the
use
national
for
interest.
That information.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
If I'm the president and I have to decide when I'm going to call this foreign leader to try to make the strongest case I can for them to support us on X or Y, I really would love to know from the intelligence analysts, when are they most vulnerable or when are they most receptive to it, depending on a whole range of factors in their own country.
Now, how many people directly go into making the PDB? I'm not talking about agents on the ground,
sure,
field agents and that kind of thing. But
it varies widely. You can interpret it one way as the entire intelligence community does. That
sure.
is, right now, at least for the past 10 years since the Office of the Director of National Intelligence has taken over the PDB process from the CIA, anyone in the intelligence community can write for the PDB. And if you're an expert on a particular country that's being written about for the PDB, it doesn't matter what agency or department you're in. You get to coordinate on that product to make sure the president gets the benefit of all of the experts in the community. So any given piece on any given day could have dozens of people who are involved in crafting it and honing it. On the other hand, if you're the analyst on some country in Africa that does not have a lot of people analyzing it, you might have the ability to write a piece for the president, have it edited, touched on by a few people, but essentially go to the president with your words going right into his eyes. That's a lot of impact. Nothing goes directly to the president without editing and without managers. It's going to be looked at. But it is a process whereby the experts get their opinion across to the leadership.
Yeah, and that's one thing that I always found interesting about how our intelligence institutions operate, in that you have agents on the ground, field agents and whatnot overseas, and you have analysts working, you know, around the clock. And within a day,
right.
that field agent in Hungary or in right. Pakistan or wherever, they can come up with something that ends up right there with the president's breakfast in the morning, the very next morning.
That's right.
Amazing.
That's right. There's a story in the book going back a couple of decades, back to Ronald Reagan, where there was an assassination in India of the prime minister. And it happened overnight, Washington time. And that's the kind of thing that is very hard to get ahead of.
Mm-hmm.
Well, guess what? They called the analyst in, dark 30 in the morning. They write up an assessment, not only of what has happened based on very limited press reports, but who could have done it? What does it mean? What's the likely reaction? What are you going to see today? And sure enough, President Reagan that morning was reading a piece on that to prepare him for the reaction to that assassination.
Is there ever a light day at the Director of National Intelligence where
right.
you have to come up with filler or throw in some stuff that maybe ordinarily wouldn't make it in there?
Yeah, it's like any daily newspaper in that sense. If you have 8 pages and you have to fill those 8 pages, there are some days where those stories aren't immediately pressing that day. But there are enough issues with 197 countries around the world and various functional and transnational issues. There's always something the president can benefit from. But then the opposite happens. There are some days when there's so much going on. There's crises in 3 different places around the world that you can't get everything into the president's daily brief. I have to tell you, the president's daily brief is the focal point for intelligence analysis for the president at the highest level. But it is not the only channel. The White House Situation Room gets raw reporting to the president. National Security Advisor for any president has the ability to call him or walk in at any point with a national security crisis. So it is a daily thing that focuses the president's attention on intelligence and national security, but it is not the only thing.
Yeah, and on the flip side of that, you talk about the pressure for analysts to throw in everything that they can because they're trying to cover their ass. Because if something goes down,
right.
they don't want to look like they dropped the ball.
That's right. And there's 2 sides to that. One is well-intentioned, the other one less so. In the latter, it could be cover your ass. It could be we don't want to be in a position where we have to defend ourselves because we didn't inform the president. And there probably is some of that. On the other hand, what I saw a whole lot more was, damn it, the president needs to know this. I see this on my account, whatever it is that I'm working on.
Mm-hmm.
And if he doesn't know that this is happening within the political leadership of this country, we're not doing our job. The whole reason we have this intelligence collection, the whole reason we have this intelligence analysis is to help narrow the range of uncertainty for the president, who has to make some pretty damn tough decisions on a daily basis on national security. I saw a whole lot of people working really hard, fighting, yelling at editors and managers, this has to get in the PDB. How can you not put this in front of the president? And usually in that battleground of ideas, the best ideas did float to the top and the president did get what he needed to know.
Yeah, and that came into play after 9/11.
Right.
And that's really how the PDP became fairly publicly acknowledged for the first time in mainstream media.
Sure.
Talk about what happened there.
Yeah, it had been discussed before that. You can even find a picture from the late 1960s, which I have in the book as well, of Lyndon Johnson and his wife and one of their grandkids sitting and reading a document that clearly says President's Daily Brief on the front. Even at a time when it wasn't universally acknowledged that the president was getting this, it was pretty clear. Kissinger referred to it in a press conference in the early 70s. But it wasn't in the public consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
9/11 really brought that forward because there was a piece in August 2001, one of several pieces that day. And of course, the president is getting this book at least 6 days a week then. And it was called Bin Laden Determined to Strike in U.S. And it made a reference to hijackings. Now, it did not refer to the actual plot with hijackings. Turned out to be reporting that was very different and did not come to fruition. But sure enough, the commission was going to investigate that, and they did. They got access to the president's daily brief in a way that had never happened in any other investigation before. Because of that, you had public hearings, and you had the 9/11 commission report published as a book, which talked explicitly about the president's daily brief, how it was produced, what kind of information was in there, and then specifically how it related to 9/11. Because of that, it really did open the book on this book, and the president's daily brief became an issue for public scrutiny in a way it never had before.
Now, even though we call it the president's daily brief, and it is specifically tailored to him and his attention, he's not the only person who sees the president's daily brief.
That's right.
Who else gets to see the president's daily brief, or does that change depending
on
the president's
whim? And it does change on the president. Each president gets to decide who else gets to see it. The predecessor to the PDB was the President's Intelligence Checklist for John F. Kennedy. When that started, he was getting it and a couple of people at the White House. And after a few months, they realized he was tasking the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense to do things based on what he read, and they were caught unawares. So they decided, let's start giving it to them. So they gave it to the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, and soon a few other people. But they never gave it to the vice president. Lyndon Johnson became president. He did not even know that the president's intelligence checklist existed. Since that time, most presidents have included the vice president. They've also almost always included the Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense. Some presidents, notably Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, have expanded the readership of the PDB wider than most other presidents.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, probably more than 30, 40 people are getting the PDB. That depends on what the president is using it for. I can make an argument either way. It can't contain the most sensitive stuff if 40 people are getting it. On the other hand, if you limit it to yourself and one other person, you're not going to be able to talk to anybody about it. So what's the point?
Yeah, and you say that there's a tendency for the distribution of the book to expand as top-level interest fades. Now, both Bushes restricted the number of recipients, and Obama, and as you also mentioned, Bill Clinton, included a larger group, including, I think Obama even has a speechwriter receiving the PDB.
Mm-hmm.
What can we then read into that?
Well, it goes two ways. From the president's point of view, and it ultimately is the president's decision, the president may decide, I'm having national security decisions with this wide range of people. They need to see what I see. And I think that was the decision behind Ben Rhodes, the person who's primarily doing speech writing and national security assistance there to get the PDB. On the other hand, the intelligence leadership itself is always trying to make sure they have an audience, that they have people who want to get this and are getting this. And over time, they have sometimes pushed for other people to get the book. To the extent that there's a conflict with the president wins, no doubt about that. But sometimes the president doesn't want to micromanage to that level, and he can be influenced by advisors and others who want to spread it around.
Really? So the intelligence community pushes to have a broader audience for it sometimes.
It hasn't always happened.
Because I would think that they would want a smaller audience
so
that they can give him more classified information and they don't have to worry about it falling into the hands of the speechwriter or the secretary.
Sure. Yeah, two things have happened historically on that. On one hand, to the extent that the distribution has gone wider, What they found is they found ways to get the sensitive information to the president, either orally or by putting a special supplement in just his copy. So they still get it to the president. On the other hand, you do have the case where sometimes they have said, Mr. President, are you sure you want to add that person? There are plenty of stories in the book in various administrations about people who requested being added to the distribution list. And the intelligence community pushed them away subtly and sometimes went to the president and got authority to push them away. And then even in one case, George W. Bush had cut back the book so much that he initially ruled out the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who'd been getting it for 30 years. And the CIA understood that and said, great that you want to take it that seriously, that you want to restrict this information. But here's somebody who's probably going to be in on all of those sensitive discussions. Are you sure about that? And sure enough, the chairman ended up getting re-added to the very small list that George W. Bush had.
Has there ever been a first lady who tried to get the PDV?
I tell you, I don't know the inside story of each administration, and I did not interview any of the first ladies. But we have the evidence of Lady Bird Johnson sitting there looking at the president reading it. And based on the way the White House works, the fact that you have living quarters very close to working quarters, it would surprise me if virtually every first lady had not had a look at the book.
Right.
Now, are they a formal recipient? Absolutely not. But I also don't see any CIA director or now director of national intelligence going and wagging a finger in the face of the president saying, I'm sorry, we don't allow that. That's something where the president's discretion rules.
Earlier, you mentioned that President Obama has updated the PDB, and now he receives it on an iPad instead of in the form of a bound book. Is there any risk in the president getting the PDB on an iPad?
Well, there would be if it were an iPad like the one that you and I have.
Right.
This is a very special piece of equipment. This iPad does not have the security vulnerabilities that any of ours would have. Trust me, both White House security and the intelligence services would not let anything go that would be easily tapped into. It is still tightly controlled as an item, whether the item is a book or an iPad. The actual medium for communicating the analysis is still controlled tightly. What it does do is it actually opens up some interesting opportunities, because with a printed book, you can print out a map, you can print out graphics, charts, you could bring in videos to supplement the book. With the iPad, you can do all that right on the tablet itself.
Yeah.
You can have interactive graphics, you could have videos, you could have all kinds of things. It doesn't change what's in the book at the ultimate level. It's still intelligence analysis based on classified sources, but it does open up opportunities for some interesting presentations.
And some people have brought this up.
Yeah.
If you turn the PDB into essentially the equivalent of a Drudge Report or Huffington Post, where the president can click and delve deeper, does it put our intelligence agencies in the position of spending way more resources on being journalists than actually collecting and analyzing intelligence?
That's an interesting point. Is does the presentation take over from the analysis? Does the function and the form get confused? I don't see that happening, because essentially what the intelligence analysis mostly is on an iPad, just like on printed paper, is words. It's logic, it's argumentation, it's evidence from intelligence sources leading to a conclusion, even if that conclusion is not fully certain because of the nature of the event out there in the world. That's true no matter what. But it's a good point. If a president decides to take it a step further, they want the PDB in the form of haiku or interpretive dance, well, that's going to be really hard to communicate some of those messages.
Well, also, in this 24-hour news cycle now, I mean, if it is truly mimicking a mainstream news source, you would think that the PDB would be updated throughout the day.
Right.
And that's obviously requires a lot more resources, too.
Yeah, and that is an interesting step for the future of the president's daily brief. There's no reason that couldn't happen. There's no reason, technologically, that there couldn't be an updated document every hour, every half hour, live feed going in to the president. Now, the White House already has something for that, the White House Situation Room, which collects all the information, classified and otherwise. So in a sense, they already have that and have had that for decades. But the PDB could certainly evolve into that. I could imagine in the future the president carrying around a tablet that has some very secure method of live updating that does update situations all the time and alerts the president for certain things that he or she has decided that an update immediately is required. Right now, I don't think we're seeing that. The president's daily brief is still daily. That used to mean frequent. Now, daily means not frequent. With a 24-hour news cycle, daily seems a little bit slow.
Right.
It's more of a stand-back product to look at a situation instead of giving the president minute-to-minute updates.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it could also be a distraction. It'd be,
sure.
Be like the president walking around playing Pokemon Go or something.
Right. which would be a fun way to look at the intelligence. Maybe that's an idea.
There you
Let's
go.
Write that down.
There you go. Update it. Yeah. I don't know if I necessarily made this clear in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
There are two elements to it in most cases. There is the president's daily brief,
right.
The book or the iPad that's delivered to him. And then there is the briefer and the president's daily briefing, which
right.
You were one of the briefers.
Yes.
Who came and physically delivered it and then answered questions and had an interaction with the president. Many people feel that that itself is a waste of resources.
Sure.
If you're using 12 of your best analysts, you're not sending in interns. Instead of being at their desk doing analysis, they're
right.
You know, having to socialize with the cabinet members.
It's a big investment. You take some of the top analysts on various accounts and you decide they're good communicators. They have good judgment. We're going to make them briefers. Well, okay. They're the pointy end of the spear when it comes to intelligence analysis, getting that message to the customers. But you're right. You're taking some good brains off of some very important topics. The intelligence community, thankfully, is big enough that rarely happens on major accounts. There are lots of smart people looking at things. But that is a real issue. The benefit of the briefer, and I witnessed this as a briefer. I saw this under a couple of administrations. You get to go beyond what's on the printed page. If the president or someone whom the president has designated to receive the book, like my customers, the attorney general and the FBI director, if they have a question about what's behind something, or if they're thinking about taking an action based on it and they want to be sure, so they want to probe the confidence level or alternative explanations for what's being described, you can do that with a briefer live in person. That's a lot harder to do with a printed document. Then you have to get
yeah.
a question back, hope to get a memo that day or the next day. So there is a real benefit to getting that
yeah.
briefing. Some people, of course, don't process information that way. Some people process better by reading, and a conversation would be a distraction to them. I'm open to that, but all things equal, a briefing makes a whole lot more sense because you get that value added that you really don't get any other way so efficiently.
Yeah. You say that most presidents have missed opportunities to make more of the president's daily brief.
Right.
What are a couple of examples of that?
Yeah, I look back at a president like Bill Clinton, who did not take briefings every day just because his schedule was so haywire. In talking with him and others who worked with him, it appears he did make good use of the PDB on many important issues. But he acknowledges that early on in his administration that he did not. They had to learn some lessons about Somalia and other things that could have been averted by better use of the PDB. Some presidents have also not really used it to dig deeper into intelligence. That is, they've just read it and said, okay, so that's the opinion of those people. Good enough. Instead of using it as a challenge to them and going back to them. The model here probably is George W. Bush. George W. Bush not only took a briefing every working day, which his father had done, but he decided to take a CIA briefer with him whenever he traveled. Anywhere he traveled, overseas or domestically, he would have a CIA briefer with him if that was going to be the time of the PDB briefing normally in Washington. And what that meant is on a day like 9/11, you've got live intel support there beyond just
yeah.
the White House security mechanism, but you've got a CIA officer who has seen you every morning talking about the intelligence, knowing how you process the intelligence, who can serve a valuable function. That makes a whole lot of sense.
Are there things that were in the PDB that the president just didn't act on or should have acted on?
You know, I didn't find a lot of examples of that. Certainly found some examples of the analysis that just was wrong,
mm-hmm.
in which case the president might have read it, and whether they took it or not doesn't matter. The big one is the 1973 war between Egypt and Israel.
Mm-hmm.
The day of the invasion, the analysis in the PDB was, there won't be an invasion. That's about as bad as it gets.
Yeah, all's clear.
Now, missing a coup attempt or missing something that is a true surprise, you can take a hit on the intel community for not seeing that. But a coup attempt by its very nature is really hard to predict. If the intelligence service in that country, whose in some cases lives depend on preventing coup attempts, they don't see it, that's a high mark to put on the CIA. But on a whole lot of other issues, they appear to have given the president warning. Maybe not warning of what was going to happen any particular day, but warning about trend lines, warning about ideas that were starting to percolate that would inform those national security decisions?
Well, before we go, now that Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are the nominees, they are now getting intelligence briefings. Is that the same as the president's daily briefing, or is it cherry-picked? Is it different?
It's neither of those. It's really like the PDB light. That is, it's a no-kidding classified intelligence briefing. It is intelligence analysis about the hotspots around the globe that are out there. But it does not contain direct information about intelligence sources and methods. It doesn't name the spies overseas. It doesn't reveal how we know this and who we're listening to. All of that can appear in the president's daily brief. The president can get anything that he wants in that book. For the candidates, it's much more generic. It is a no-kidding classified briefing. It's based on those sources, but it is at a higher level. Because of that, it's sensitive. It's a real thing. There is concern about Hillary Clinton, who has been called out by the FBI director for being careless with classified information. Mm-hmm. Some people say Donald Trump because of the fact that he seems unable to filter what he says. He says what he's thinking. Mm-hmm. Well, both of those present a concern for classified information by definition, but the information in the classified intelligence briefings for candidates is not the same as what's in the president's book of secrets.
Okay. And they're not getting daily briefings, probably. Though.
No, they are not. Okay. They can request multiple briefings. Many presidents have received multiple briefings during the campaign to stay up on issues. Jimmy Carter, he loved intelligence so much that even during a very busy campaign, 1976, he requested multiple briefings that lasted over 6 hours. Somehow he still had enough time to campaign and win the election over Gerald Ford. But that's up to a negotiation between each candidate and whomever the president has designated to handle the process. This year, it's the Director of National Intelligence. They've given Trump his briefing already, and I haven't heard anything leaking out of that. And supposedly, they're in negotiations with Hillary Clinton about when she's going to get hers, although we have no word on that as of this time.
Well, once again, the book is called The President's Book of Secrets, The Untold Story of Intelligence Briefings to America's Presidents from Kennedy to Obama by David Preece. David, thanks for coming in to talk to me about it.
Ben, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks.
Thanks again to David Preece for coming on the show. And if you enjoyed today's episode, then you'll love his new book, The President's Book of Secrets, The Untold Story of Intelligence Briefings to America's Presidents from Kennedy to Obama. I'll include an Amazon link where you can order it in the show notes for this episode and on our website at kickassnewspodcast.com. Or if you'd prefer to listen to the audio version, you can download that for free through a special trial offer just for our listeners at audibletrial.com/kickassnews. You can follow David at his website at davidpreece.com, spelled P-R-I-E-S-S, or on Twitter at David Preece. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickassnews. Or if you prefer, you can set up a recurring monthly contribution at patreon.com/kickassnews. You can visit Kick-Ass News on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at KA Politics. And please be sure to recommend Kick-Ass News to all your friends on your social media. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnewspodcast.com. But for now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.